710 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. Israel launches a preemptive strike overnight on the militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel claiming the attack was necessary because Hezbollah was planning a strike of its own first, and Hezbollah has reacted, firing hundreds of rockets into northern Israel with drones and missiles aimed at military targets. Dozens of Israeli jets, meanwhile, hitting targets in southern Lebanon. In the U.S., in the presidential race, it's heating up with just a couple of months until Election Day. Republicans are energized, too, after Robert F. Kennedy Jr. endorsed former President Trump on Friday.
I'm here to tell you that I will leverage your tremendous accomplishments to serve the ideals that we share, the ideals of peace, of prosperity, of freedom, of health, all the ideals that motivated my campaign.
Democrats are feeling good after their star-studded convention in Chicago this week, nominating Kamala Harris for president. This is ABC News. A statue of the late civil rights leader and Congressman John Lewis unveiled before a crowd in a city park in Georgia.
The crowd included neighbors, politicians, and civil rights leaders who applauded when a black veil was pulled down to reveal the 12-foot-tall statue of Lewis at Decatur's historic square.
It's going to be life-changing.
I'm 82 years old, so I have seen a lot, and this is really good for us.
DeKalb County Chief Executive Mike Thurman to WSB-TV.
Something that will be lasting, inspiring, and something that will bring us together.
Lewis died in 2020 from pancreatic cancer. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Italian authorities are launching a manslaughter investigation into the sinking of that super yacht off the Sicilian coast. Authorities say the ship's crew may be to blame for the tragedy. Seven people died. Their remains were recovered one by one by divers over the past week. Some of the victims include Americans. I'm Derek Dennis, ABC News.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. A question I get a lot from people at the beginning of their money journey is, how should I invest my money? Okay, time for some real talk. That's a great question, best asked after you've paid off any high interest debt. You know, making 7% per year in an index fund when you're paying 28% on a credit card, it just doesn't add up. So get rid of that high interest debt first, and then you'll be set to make investment choices that can really pay off. And, pro tip, while I paid down my high interest debt in my 20s, I also made sure to put at least $1,000 away for emergencies, you know, like car breakdowns, so I could keep as out of debt as possible. And that was today's Work Money Minute. For more everyday money tips, check out Work Money Media on YouTube, or you can text MONEY, M-O-N-E-Y, to 88285. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Libraries are pushing back against the proposals in Project 2025, the so-called wish list for the next Republican president. Mark Moran reports.
The latest report from the Every Library Institute says the Republican Party's agenda, as outlined in the document known as Project 2025, takes aim at places where students can read, discover, and explore. Conservatives call it a matter of accountability. In Iowa, there are at least 540 public libraries, fourth highest in the nation. More than 400 are among the scant cultural resources in towns with populations of less than 2,500. Peter Bromberg with the Institute says Project 2025, a massive effort to reclassify civil service workers as political appointees, would take direct aim at libraries and the people who work there.
You know, librarians and teachers are highly trusted and well-known and well-loved in their communities. It's really kind of a shocking and extreme attempt to twist our democratic society and our institutions into more of a totalitarian theocracy.
But backers of Project 2025 say librarians need to be held accountable for what's on their shelves. Bromberg says Project 2025 promotes book bans, restricts LGBTQ content, and undermines the intellectual freedom and inclusivity that libraries are known for. He believes that would ultimately threaten students' educational quality and could presage the end of libraries serving as open and inclusive spaces for people who want to learn. This is Mark Moran for Iowa News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see mostly sunny skies for today. South winds and highs in the upper 80s. Tonight, more clouds and upper 60s. Monday, we'll see mostly sunny and hot conditions. Highs in the lower 90s, close to record territory. A couple of storms will develop in the afternoon hours. It's 78 at our studios.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel entertainment reporter Chris Foran joins the show to talk movies and TV. And Wisconsin native comedian Mary Mack joins the show to talk about her tour of the state.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and this is our weekend weekly venued broadcast. My name is Jim Santel. Delighted to have you with me this weekend for our weekend review of all things related to government, law, and the aspiration for justice in America and beyond as well. As always, we take our name, our adopted commission here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, from the notion of a friend, Amicus. Amicus Curiae is a friend of the court. Ami is the Latin. That's where we derive our name. It's an individual and organization that assists somehow in understanding, appreciation, assessment of some relevant issues that are out there for decision, for debate, for analysis. And that indeed is our purpose here on this, our weekend broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review, encouraging you as well to be a part of our analysis, our review, our discussion by engaging with my wonderful producer Max and me, questions, inquiries about the subject matters that we're talking about this weekend here on the broadcast. As always, you can reach Max and me at 844-967-2789. Also, send us an inquiry, a question on the Civic Media app, and we will get to that as well. Delighted not only to have your listening engagement in our discussion, but also your participation in it. And so do just that here on Amicus, a Law Review. What is our syllabus for this weekend's broadcast? As always, ambitious but achievable. As always, focused upon those issues related to law and government, and yes, indeed, the aspiration for justice. It is that time of year when we think about what we're doing in our summer vacations. It's a bit early for our grade school and even high school teachers to be asking students to report on what they have done during the course of their previous summers. But we're going to begin this weekend broadcast with some examination of what our Supreme Court justices have been doing in the months of July and August, and maybe even into September or so, before they return to the next term of their review of cases. That, of course, is the 2024-2025 term. We spend some time talking about how the Supreme Court justices, at least some of them, who've disclosed this information, where they are, what they're doing, some academic things, and some visits around the world. Then we're also going to talk about other things that are going on in the court, even in this so-called down period. In fact, the Supreme Court's been active on its so-called emergency application docket. That's the docket that recently Associate Justice Elena Kagan was critical of. Way too many applications, she says, fall into this category of emergency applications, when in fact they're really not. And so we're going to talk about what the Supreme Court has on its docket in this so-called emergency system here before the Supreme Court. And we'll talk about the kinds of things that the Supreme Court is going to be doing in these months, even while we're all in a summer vacation kind of mode. Beyond that, we're going to talk about other things related to the actions of the Supreme Court in that docket, including a major decision, really a non-decision by the Supreme Court, a decision not to overturn a rule, a regulation, some legislation coming out of, once again, the state of Arizona, having to do with voting restrictions and, in particular, the mandates attended upon people who want to register for the first time in Arizona. We're going to talk about what is coming out of the state of Arizona and also make reference once again to the fact that Arizona was also the source, the hotbed, if you will, of that case a number of years ago called Brnovich, the second major blow in recent times to the Voting Rights Act. And we'll chat with the Supreme Court, even in its emergency docket, did just this past week in connection with a major registration restriction there in the state of Arizona. A couple of other things also coming out of courts across our land. The Arkansas Supreme Court refusing to permit on the referendum this coming November in that state, in the state of Arkansas, a specific question about abortion rights, a proposal to promote the notion of privacy rights when it comes to reproductive rights there in Arkansas. Supreme Court just this past week declining to permit that to appear on the ballot in November. We'll tell you all about that as well. And then we also have a federal district court judge in Kansas, in Wichita, a stunning decision. It's a district court, it's a trial court decision of just this past week, finding for the first time in our recent history, our nation's history, that the prohibition, longstanding, established by the Congress many years ago on the possession and use of machine guns in our land, in the United States of America, is not in fact constitutional. Striking down a proposal for the challenge, for the prosecution of an individual there in Kansas who is charged with possessing a machine gun, and finding that particular law under which that person was charged is unconstitutional. We'll talk all about that at a time when we're also thinking, of course, about elections. All of these issues, abortion rights, privacy rights, gun rights, registration, the access that we have to voting in particular, all of that very much in our national consciousness as we think through this present campaign. Then we've got some review of some recent guilty pleas and adjudications of guilt in various areas around the country. We've got a lawyer who was representing the Oath Keepers. Remember them? This group, including one in particular, found guilty of insurrectionist-type offenses related to January 6th. A lawyer who was prosecuted and successfully prosecuted, found guilty of tampering with evidence in connection with that January 6th prosecution. We've got a clerk out in Colorado who is engaged in election interference there, an attempt to undermine the results of the Colorado result there. And we're going to talk about that case as well. And then, of course, we're going to talk about the plea entered by, yes, that's right, George Santos, just this past week as well. George Santos, for the recent years, has indeed been in our nation's attention, our nation's focus, for a great many things, always denying having engaged in any inappropriate behavior. Certainly no admission of any criminal conduct. Just this past week, George Santos, former congressman, former member of the United States House of Representatives, pleading guilty. And we'll talk about what he pled guilty to and the likelihood that he will spend some time in federal prison at some point down the road. No sentencing anytime soon, but a major result in that particular case. And then in our second hour, if not even before then, we're going to chat about some other major things that are going on in litigation out there. One of them is a major announcement by the Attorney General, the federal Attorney General. Of course, his name is Merrick Garland. Has announced just this past week a major piece of antitrust litigation involving rents and landlords and tenants. We'll talk about what that's all about and why it too is significant when it comes to understanding the present campaign for the presidency and other positions in our local and state and national governments. We're also going to talk about a challenge brought to a proposal, a plan put in place, just initiated recently by the Biden administration, to aid undocumented spouses of American citizens. We'll talk about that immigration plan and the challenge now brought to that in federal court by a number of states and individuals who maintain that it is unconstitutional. Obviously, no resolution of that decision yet, but we'll talk about the premises for that. And finally, going back to other news from just last week's broadcast, I want to talk about what happened in Venezuela just this past week with its Supreme Court, a Supreme Court that, yes, indeed, affirmed over the international objections and the findings of an awful lot of people out there that their recent presidential election was, in fact, the result of fraud and the result of corruption there. The Supreme Court in Venezuela, nonetheless, finding that the results, the officially announced results by the Maduro campaign, the Maduro presidency, are in place. We'll talk about what that means and the significance of all of that in the international realm of rule of law. Let us begin then. Let us begin in this broad and spanning discussion of many things across our nation, across our globe, with talking about the United States Supreme Court. What are they doing? What are they doing after this major blockbuster and contentious term that spilled over into July, including the July 1, the major catastrophic decision on July 1, finding that a president of the United States of America cannot be prosecuted for crimes committed, certain crimes committed, while in the presidency. A landmark blockbuster case, along with others, including this other case involving the change in which federal judges give deference to the agency decisions, executive expertise, understanding, and the agencies no more as a result of what the Supreme Court, among about 60 other cases, did in just this past term. Well, the reality is that even though all of those cases, those major cases, 60 of them, the subjects of oral argument and then decisions in almost all of them, finished pretty much in late June, early July, the Supreme Court justices are active in two major areas. One of them is their own individual activities. We're going to talk about those in just a moment or so. And then, interruptions in those vacation plans, if you will, for the emergency docket cases. We'll talk about what they've got in front of them and what they may yet resolve in the coming weeks. We'll talk about one of those cases on the emergency docket. That is this case coming out of Arizona and new voter registration. So let's begin. Let's begin by talking about what the Supreme Court members, or at least some of them, have been doing in this summer term. Chief Justice John Roberts. Chief Justice John Roberts headed off to Galway, Ireland in July for a teaching gig, a teaching assignment on, yes, that's right, Supreme Court history. It's a part of a New England Law in Boston program that's hosted by the University of Galway. So the Chief Justice in Ireland last month for that particular academic presentation. Justice Neil Gorsuch, Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch, traveled to Porto, Portugal in mid-July. And there he was teaching, also providing some academic instruction in a two-week seminar on the separation of powers, an interesting topic for him, for any Supreme Court justice to talk about, that taking place as a part of the George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School program. And when Justice Gorsuch returned, he launched a whirlwind schedule of press interviews, as you may know, for his latest book. It's called Overrule, The Human Toll of Too Much Law. Justice Gorsuch, very busy, as is Justice Jackson, Ketanji Brown Jackson, also putting the finishing touches on her own book, a memoir titled Lovely One, to be published on September 3rd. All of that happening this past summer. When we return here on Amicus, more about what the Supreme Court's been doing in its emergency docket here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast format? Search no more. Find it now on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com. Your news just for the Superior area. I'm James Kelly with WBZH News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot. Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was when they moved the camera. Whenever it's like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media as we talk, as we always do in our weekend-venued discussion of law and justice and the rule of law, the administration of justice in America. And that, of course, also includes our United States Supreme Court spending a lot of time on this broadcast talking about these major earth-shaking, cataclysmic decisions in some way coming out of the Supreme Court just this past year. Also talking now about what the Supreme Court justices are doing, not in this hiatus period because they're still active, but some of the travels around the world that some of them are engaging in. And that has also included Elena Kagan. We had spoken before about her presence at the Ninth Circuit Judicial Conference out in Sacramento, California, in late July. And at that time, you may recall well that she talked a lot about this idea of an ethics code, proposing publicly for the first time that the Chief Justice, of course, that's John Roberts, that he established a group of judges, lower court judges, district court judges, appellate court judges with reputation and respect to make decisions to enforce this so-called code of ethics that should be out there. She spoke about the fact that the particular assemblage of documents and principles and standards that the Supreme Court has put together to this point have no teeth, no enforcement. So she was recommending when she had traveled to Sacramento, California, and this judicial conference that a group of lower court judges be the ones, the arbiters, the deciding players here in making determinations about when cases should be heard by justices. And also these other issues related to income and travel, all of that coming out of Elena Kagan's trip to California just this past term. She said, our summers used to be actually summers. She said, it was one of the great things about our calendar is that it was spaced out. This is Elena Kagan speaking, so that we could have a break before we went back to the hothouse of decision-making with the new term. And just the relentless bringing of these emergency petitions, she said, make that not the case anymore. So she's talking not only about ethics, but also this wildly increasing docket, sometimes called the shadow docket, certainly the emergency application docket. And among other things, she described very interestingly returning to her hotel room in Sacramento, receiving some urgent communications from her law clerks about matters that were now populating the emergency docket, even during this post-decisional period. She said, I have four new law clerks. And the thing about new law clerks, she said, is that they always write you more than you actually want to know. Went on to say, and so my four law clerks wrote me about four separate emergencies. They're at the court right now, and some of them deserving a long memorandum, and some, she said, possibly not. And that's her point. She said some of these things, some of these reasons for coming to the court on an emergency basis, not in fact truly emergencies, and could indeed wait the regular course of conduct beginning with the October term. So while she didn't specify the specific cases that she's talking about, we know from the emergency matters that are on the docket in this sort of post-decisional period, the Supreme Court has got a number of them, and that includes something like this. The West Virginia versus Environmental Protection Agency cases, some related applications there. In those multiple actions, several states and some industry groups are asking the court, again, as a part of an emergency application right now, do it immediately, to block an EPA regulation that will limit carbon emissions in coal and gas-fired power plants beginning as soon as 2030. That's their petition to the court, even now, and asking the court to stop the implementation of this rule
even in the middle of the summer here. The Biden administration filed its response on August 19th. Presumably, there may be some determination of that fairly soon. Another case, Biden versus Missouri and Alaska versus Department of Education. This is also a complicated set of filings, again, seeking an emergency review by the Supreme Court. Both the Biden administration and several states are asking the court to weigh in on the administration's SAVE plan, S-A-V-E, that's the acronym, of course, to provide this income-based student loan relief. We talked a lot about that in our previous broadcast. So asking the court, again, to step in and ensure that the plan is permitted to go ahead over the stopping of that plan by lower courts. There's another case called Department of Education versus Louisiana and Cardona versus Tennessee. Nationwide, about 26 states in these applications challenging a Biden administration regulation that interprets Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. That, as you may recall well from our previous discussions, that's a statute that bars sex discrimination in federally funded schools and colleges. And it includes sexual orientation and gender identity. The question is whether or not that also provides protections, of course, for transgender students. Multiple federal courts have blocked the regulation of the administration. The administration sought partial stays on two of those injunctions, fairly complicated along the way. But those stays would have allowed provisions of the rule that were unchallenged and were mostly less controversial to take effect across the country. And of course, all of that incredibly important, even in connection with the Supreme Court's overall review in this coming term of transgender issues. We know that it's also got on its docket, not in an emergency application status, a review of a case involving care, medical care for transgender patients. That's on the docket. All of this coming up in connection with an emergency application right now, asking the court to make a decision right away because of this opinion, this view, this advocacy, that if they don't act immediately, bad things will happen again. Sonia Sotomayor and I suspect other members of the Supreme Court identifying now this emergency docket as being overused, perhaps by people on both sides of the political aisle. Certainly we saw a great increase in it during the Trump administration, not falling back a whole lot, if at all, during the Biden administration as these things go forward. And there is indeed, as a part of this emergency docket, a major decision, or almost a non-decision, by the Supreme Court just this past week in connection with voter registration. Again, this is not a part of its regular review of cases coming up in October, a part of what will probably be another 60 cases or so. This is one of these applications that comes up on an emergency request by parties for review by the Supreme Court. What happened? What happened just this past week coming out of the state of Arizona having to do with voter registration? The Supreme Court, at least for now, allowing Arizona to follow and to enforce some tough new voting registration requirements, basically saying that people registering to vote for the first time before the coming election have to show proof of citizenship. That's what the law has said. And the Supreme Court, in this terse, fairly unsigned order, handed a partial victory to those then who wanted that particular rule, that regulation to go into effect, supporting this 2022 Arizona law, imposing these new restrictions having to do with showing proof of citizenship on voting. Significantly, the court refused to allow Arizona to put in effect another part of that law, which could have prohibited probably about tens of thousands of voters already registered from participating in the presidential election or casting any ballots by mail unless they provided proof of citizenship. So it's a bit of a mixed result here. But the big one is, you want to register for the first time, you've got to show proof of citizenship in the state of Arizona. Supreme Court refusing to overturn that just this past week as we continue with Amicus, a law review, more on the emergency docket of the Supreme Court.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allball Show.
ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. Israel launches a preemptive strike overnight on the militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel claiming the attack was necessary because Hezbollah was planning a strike of its own first, and Hezbollah has reacted, firing hundreds of rockets into northern Israel with drones and missiles aimed at military targets. Dozens of Israeli jets, meanwhile, hitting targets in southern Lebanon. In the U.S., in the presidential race, it's heating up with just a couple of months until Election Day. Republicans are energized, too, after Robert F. Kennedy Jr. endorsed former President Trump on Friday.
I'm here to tell you that I will leverage your tremendous accomplishments to serve the ideals that we share, the ideals of peace, of prosperity, of freedom, of health, all the ideals that motivated my campaign.
Democrats are feeling good after their star-studded convention in Chicago this week, nominating Kamala Harris for president. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers win again in Oakland. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers took the lead in Game 2, then added some insurance runs late on the way to a 9-5 victory over the A's. Milwaukee's Jake Bowers had a home run, also scored three more times in the game. Brewers manager Pat Murphy on those extra runs in the 8th and 9th.
Really important. Tacking on is however you want to term it. Staying after it, being relentless, pecking away, however you want to term it. It's the key to a Major League game because it's hard to win a Major League game and there's really good players on both sides.
NFL, the Packers have the next 3 days off after beating the Ravens yesterday 30-7 in front of 72,000 fans at Lambeau Field. Matt LaFleur on Packers linebacker Christian Welch, who grew up in Iola, Wisconsin.
He's just a smart, tough, physical player. I thought that interception that he had was an outstanding play. It looked like, to me, he baited the quarterback right there as a hook player and just made a great break on the ball and made the play. And then he had a heck of a return.
That's Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see mostly sunny skies for today. South winds and highs in the upper 80s. Tonight, more clouds and upper 60s. Monday, we'll see mostly sunny and hot conditions. Highs in the lower 90s, close to record territory. A couple of storms will develop in the afternoon hours. It's 78 at our studios.
It all starts with a question more than 75 years ago. Can hauling a fishing pole to the water hole be made easier? Bob and Bill Johnson find an answer, and the very first multi-section bamboo fishing pole is created. It's 1948. The brothers' invention also leads to the launch of St. Croix Rod Company in Park Falls, and it becomes the talk of the state. So do you know which fish is considered the prize catch in Wisconsin? Is it northern pike, bluegill, or walleye? The answer coming up. The St. Croix Rod Company continues to call Park Falls home, but now operates what is considered the most advanced facility in the country. The company offers more than 800 award-winning rods and reels, still being created as the answer to every angler's fishing question. So which fish is the prized catch? Walleye.
Yeah.
It's challenging to catch, delicious to eat. And this is not the one that got away, but is one true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Gwyneth Paltrow, she has a company called Goop. You remember that project she sold? She found a way to bottle the scent of her privates.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yep.
That's a little pretentious. That's the last thing I would want to inflict on the population. Hey, everybody. Here's Pete's crotch. Line up. You can get it fresh here at the farmer's market, or you can buy it in aisle 4.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Busted pencils.
Fully leaded education talk.
If the beef of Tim Walz is that he spent money on children, on what they needed, whether that be universal meals or whether that be, you know, record amounts for a state to invest in early childhood development. I am like, man, you are critiquing this guy and making him even more my hero.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Todd Albaugh. Join us next time as we are back in Wisconsin after covering the DNC. We'll look back at the news of the weekend and get you ready for the last week in August. Badger football coming up.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name's Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about what the members of the Supreme Court are doing during their so-called summer vacation, actually not a vacation, times when they're very active, as we're indicating here on our weekend broadcast, in the areas of environmental matters involving cases involving education, both on the student loan relief issue and also this issue of Title IX and sexual orientation, gender identity prohibitions under the Education Amendments of 1972, whether those also have implications for transgender students. In that case, of course, the Supreme Court, after mulling the request and the petition for about 4 weeks or so, the High Court denied the administration's motions in an unsigned opinion on August 16th. Several justices writing partial dissents and saying they would have allowed the unchallenged provisions of that Title IX regulation to take effect. All of that a part of this emergency docket as they're reviewing cases presented to them in a so-called emergency posture, much to the chagrin and disappointment and dismay, if you will, of some members of the Supreme Court, including Elena Kagan. Also resolving, at least in part, this emergency application coming up from Arizona, talking about this in our first segments here on the broadcast. This legislation in Arizona that requires that if you want to register to vote for the first time in that state, you've got to show proof of citizenship. The decision by the Supreme Court, an unsigned order, which is not at all unusual in these emergency applications, thus giving rise to the so-called description of this as being a part of the shadow docket. Not a lot of, if any, explanation for the reasons for doing this. Handing a partial victory to those who supported this 2022 law that imposed these new restrictions on voting, declining at the same time to require the same kind of thing for people who are already registered to vote and would want to vote in the presidential election or casting their ballots by mail. So kind of a split decision in the end, but overall, a victory, if you will, for those people who wanted to impose this additional requirement for registration in Arizona. The decision, as I indicated, does not include any specific legal reasoning, thus a lot of the criticism for this process. There were signs, however, that the court was fairly divided over the issue. Chief Justice John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh may have split their votes between two factions. And although the order did not mention either one of them, it did say that four justices wanted to keep the state from enforcing both measures. And those justices are Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and yes, Amy Coney Barrett. Again, this interesting alliance developing between the so-called liberal members of the Supreme Court and Amy Coney Barrett. It named just three justices as wanting to let the state put into effect both provisions, and they're Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito and Neil Gorsuch, leaving again the sense that Roberts and Kavanaugh wanted to sort of split their vote. In the end, the mixed decision means that Arizona's newly registering voters for the coming election will have to provide copies of one of several documents, including a birth certificate or a passport, in order to prove their citizenship to vote there in Arizona. The dispute turns on this requirement to show proof of citizenship. And again, a finding previously under something called the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, that doing that, imposing a requirement to show proof of citizenship, a 2018 consent decree violates the law. And that consent decree between the state and something called the League of United Latin American Citizens, one of the oldest Latino civil rights organizations in the nation, established that it would be violative of the National Voter Registration Act to impose a proof of citizenship. And under that agreement, applicants who cannot show proof of citizenship on their state forms would still be registered to vote if their citizenship could be proved through documents from the Arizona Transportation Department. So this legislation basically overturning that previous consent decree, that previous arrangement there in Arizona. And a lower court there had blocked both the restriction involving new registration and the restriction barring already registered voting from voters from casting ballots by mail or for president if they did not show proof of citizenship. All of that, of course, comes up in appeal. And once again, the Supreme Court kind of issues a split decision here, saying, yes, portions of that can be enforced. Another portion with respect to existing registered voters cannot be enforced. Those requirements, according to the people who wanted to impose both requirements, were needed to protect, to prevent non-citizens from voting. They said allowing unqualified people to register and to cast ballots would somehow dilute the voting rights of legitimate voters and undermine overall confidence in the integrity of the electoral process there. Now, all of that, again, coming out of this decision, it's a case called Republican National Committee versus Mi Familia Vota, M-I, new word, Familia, F-A-M-I-L-I, Vota, Mi Familia Vota. That's the name of the case, emergency application, again, allowing Arizona to enforce, at least for now, this tightening of voter registration requirements there in the state of Arizona as a part of the emergency docket of the United States Supreme Court. We've got other courts in the land doing other things just this past week, again, in the area of issues that certainly will have an impact upon the present campaign, the election coming up very, very shortly in just about 70 days or so. Let's turn to the Arkansas Supreme Court, not the federal Supreme Court, but the Arkansas Supreme Court that had a major decision this past week, issuing a major ruling having to do with privacy rights, abortion rights in the state of Arkansas. A majority of the state Supreme Court there in Arkansas siding with the Secretary of State there in that state, who rejected a citizens group petition for failing to submit some of the necessary paperwork and keeping an abortion measure off the ballot, keeping it off the ballot this coming November. The Arkansas Supreme Court ruling just this past week that an abortion rights amendment was ineligible, cannot be placed on the November ballot, basically agreeing with state officials that organizers of the effort to put this initiative on the ballot had failed to submit all of the required paperwork. Now, the background of this is just this. The measure appeared all but set to proceed last month when organizers announced that they had indeed submitted the required 101,000 signatures in favor of it. That was actually more than the 90,000 signatures that were actually needed to place this constitutional amendment on the ballot. But the Secretary of State there, his name is John Thurston, rejected that petition outright. And the basis for that was this. He said that the organizers of this petition, of this referendum that otherwise would have shown up on the ballot in November having to do with abortion rights, had failed. They failed to correctly submit, get this, a sworn statement confirming that some paid canvassers getting the requisite number of signatures on this position, on this petition, that the paid canvassers had been instructed on how to collect signatures. In other words, you had to submit a certification about the education, the training given to those paid canvassers about how to collect the signatures. The organization behind this particular measure, called Arkansans for Limited Government, sued to revive the petition and forced the state officials to count all the signatures. And while the court required a count of the signatures collected by unpaid volunteers, the total, which was 87,675 or about that, came in short, according to the Secretary of State, and therefore he is keeping that petition off of the November ballot. So what happens? This goes up to the Arkansas Supreme Court, and the court finds that the Secretary of State's decision to reject the petition is right. It is constitutional. The Supreme Court also rejecting the group's related argument that, gee, give us more time, rejecting the argument that it was entitled under Arkansas law to have an additional 30 days to make up the difference in the votes that would otherwise be required to get this on the ballot. The majority of the Arkansas Supreme Court saying this, he said, we find the secretary correctly refused to count the signatures collected by paid canvassers because the sponsor failed to file the paid canvasser training certification. That's what the majority wrote in that case. Now, there was, of course, a dissent, three of the seven justices dissenting. Their names are John Dan Kemp, along with Justices Karen Baker and Courtney Hudson, all of them dissenting from this opinion. But the Secretary of State saying this, doubling down, saying, nope, during the electoral process, my staff maintains the highest professional standards, did not allow partisan politics or misinformation to deter them from their duty to comply with the law. I am dedicated, he went on to say, to my calling to serve Arkansans and will continue to do so. And for that reason, this particular referendum will not appear on the ballot in November, the Supreme Court supporting the decision of the Secretary of State. Most of the people collecting signatures for the group were unpaid volunteers. They were not paid, but a coalition of doctors worried about the effect of the current abortion law on their patients, and women upset about the end of Roe versus Wade, petition for review of that. The organization also relied on some paid canvassers as a part of getting the requisite number of individuals signing on to this petition. And so that filing on June 27th that was required to establish exactly what kind of training these paid canvassers had as a part of this process was not included with the final submission of petitions. State officials also questioned at that time whether the person who had signed that particular piece of paperwork had the authority to do so, given that she was not a formal sponsor of the ballot process. So a lot of what I think an awful lot of people would regard as highly technical reasons for not permitting this to go forward. Again, the petition not appearing on the ballot in November, in part because the requisite number of votes of statements by individuals were there, but not the certification of training of the paid canvassers there in the state of Arkansas. Interestingly, the dissenting justices acknowledged that the office's seemingly unequal application of the rules was problematic, and they would have gone in the opposite direction. They said they would have allowed the abortion rights group additional time to collect the signatures and would have appointed a special master to review all of this. Majority of the justices noted that there was never a request for a special master, and ultimately the facts necessary to decide this case were undisputed. So we've got one of the dissenting justices in this case saying this. Why are the respondent and the majority of the Supreme Court determined to keep this particular vote from the people? The majority has succeeded in its efforts to change the law in order to deprive the voters here in the state of Arkansas of the opportunity to vote on this issue, which is not the proper role of this court. That's the voice of the dissenting views of the Supreme Court. Nonetheless, the majority saying, nope, this certification of training by the paid canvassers not properly submitted, not there among the paperwork in a timely fashion, and therefore the entire petition, the entire application, the referendum in November remains off the ballot. And again, having to do with a major issue in the coming election, currently the present campaign, that having to do with voter rights when it comes to privacy and in particular reproductive rights in Arkansas and throughout the nation. We've got yet another very significant case having to do with guns, yet another issue important to the campaign and advocacy by candidates on all sides of the political aisle. This one having to do with guns. This one having to do with an application of that so-called Bruin case. You may recall well that the Supreme Court stating in Bruin a couple of years ago that in order to justify a new test for restricting or placing conditions on firearms in any way, their manufacture, their sale, their transfer, all those kinds of things, in order to do those kinds of things, those restrictions, those conditions have to be consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. In other words, looking to the history of our nation, even beyond our nation, to find a predicate for it in history. And absent finding that basis in the past, you can't support, you cannot establish a restriction in the present. That's what this case called Bruin out of New York, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association for Bruin, said a couple of years ago. An application of that just this past week by a federal district court judge in Wichita, Kansas, having to do with machine guns. And as our broadcast continues, I'll tell you all about that and the implications of Bruin for firearms in America.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about what federal judge in Wichita, Kansas, did just this past week, invoking this major decision by the Supreme Court of a couple of years ago in Bruin, finding that before you can limit access to and use of transfer sale of weapons, you got to find some predicate for it in history. That's the Bruin case. You may recall well, those of you who have listened not only to this broadcast, but the media generally talking about this major other case of just this past week, Rahimi, of this past term, rather, of just this past term by the Supreme Court, finding that an individual who is subject to a domestic violence restraining order could indeed be prohibited from carrying a weapon, seemingly turning a little bit back of the standards set forth in Bruin. The Supreme Court clarifying that the standard in Bruin, as it upheld a ban on people subject to domestic violence restraining orders having guns, saying in the Rahimi case that a modern firearms restriction need only have an historical analog and not an historical twin. An analog and not a twin doesn't have to be exactly the same. So a little bit of carving out of the Bruin standard. Well, invoking both Bruin and Rahimi, federal district court judge in Kansas just this past week dismissed the charges against a Kansas man, his name is Tamori Morgan, for possessing a machine gun, saying that prosecutors in that case had failed to establish to his satisfaction, that is the judge's satisfaction, that a federal ban on owning weapons of this nature, machine guns, is unconstitutional. It has long been the case that machine guns are illegal in this country. The Congress first moved to limit machine guns through something called the National Firearms Act way back in 1934, enacted after the weapons became commonly used by criminals during the Prohibition era, and that outright ban was later established decisively by the Congress in 1986. That's how long the ban on machine guns, domestic use here in the United States, has been in place. Well, what happens is this particular defendant, again, Tamori Morgan in Kansas, indicted. Why? Because he's got one of these machine guns. That's illegal under federal law. And he challenges that, saying that under Bruin, under Rahimi, he should be entitled to carry this weapon. And amazingly, the decision by U.S. District Judge John Brooms, B-R-O-O-M-E-S, in Wichita, appeared to agree with him, said, yes, indeed, you can't prohibit someone like this defendant from carrying, using a machine gun in America based upon what the Supreme Court said, marking the first time that a court has held that banning machine guns is unconstitutional in our nation after the Supreme Court again in this 2022 case in Bruin, after the very recent case just a few weeks ago in Rahimi, has clarified, if you will, what the standard specifically is. Brooms, who again has been a federal district court judge for some time, said that this prosecution of the defendant failed to identify an historical analog, again using the Rahimi language, to support charging him with violating the machine gun ban. And so using again the language of the Supreme Court, whether it's an analog, a twin, he says there's no analog. We can't come up with something, can't identify exactly the predicate in our nation's past that would justify the present prohibition on machine guns, a stunning decision alone in the world right now, alone in the federal judiciary. Now, undeniably, the United States Department of Justice is going to appeal that decision. And while the prosecutors themselves in the U.S. Attorney's Office there did not specifically confirm that, highly likely that this will be challenged at the appellate level and perhaps also go on to the United States Supreme Court if it's got to get back there again. The prosecutors, in defense of this prosecution, had said that while the protections of the Second Amendment are established in Bruin and Rahimi, guaranteeing the right to keep and bear arms for self-defense, the prosecutors had looked to the past, and in particular the 1700s and 1800s, to various standards and historical precedents, barring the use of dangerous and unusual weapons. That's what they said. But Judge Brooms disagreed. He said the machine gun and a Glock switch that this defendant had also used, are bearable arms within the plain text of the Second Amendment. Brooms said that those historical examples that were provided by the prosecution were simply insufficient. They were not sufficiently clear and established to support this prohibition on machine guns in place quite literally for decades. And for that reason, he finds that the law that prohibits machine guns is unconstitutional. All of that coming out of this major decision of the district court in Wichita, Kansas, just this past week. A stunning case, again, showing once again the implications of Bruin, Rahimi, even before that, the case of Heller that established way back in 2008 for the first time in our nation's history that there is inside the Second Amendment, never before interpreted this way by the Supreme Court until 2008, that there is a personal liberty right to carry, to possess a firearm in that particular case, in that Heller case, a right to self-defense for your own home. That's been the law since 2008. In Bruin, that law extended, if you will, to public places, extended beyond just the home. And for that reason, those two cases are very important. Rahimi seeming to pull back on those cases a bit and saying, well, when you look to history to justify something in the contemporary legislation, you don't have to find an exact duplicate. You don't have to find a twin. You just got to find something that's analogous to what's going on here. In this particular case, the federal judge in the District of Kansas finding that indeed what the prosecution, what the U.S. Department of Justice has presented to him in support of that analog, not the twin, but an analog, is simply not sufficient. And for that reason, the longstanding, decades-old prohibition on machine guns in America cannot be used to prosecute this particular person for possessing a machine gun there, as alleged in the indictment against him. Now, Morgan was indicted last year on these charges that he legally possessed this machine gun along, as I just indicated, with a conversion device. It's also known as a Glock switch. A Glock switch, which could also be the subject of future focus and attention, just in the way that bump stocks have been in the past. All of this now certainly going up to the appellate court there, maybe eventually to the United States Supreme Court as well. All of that continuing our discussion of the rule of law here on Amicus, a Law Review, as we continue our discussion of justice and the delivery of it here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning on Up North News Radio. The presidential race is now set and underway for the kind of 10-week ride we sure weren't expecting a month ago.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
NCAP Times Idea Fest is back for a week of powerhouse speakers and sessions exploring important local and national topics. September 15th through the 21st in Madison. This year's guest speakers include Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, former member of Congress Liz Cheney, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and historian Heather Cox Richardson, along with many others. Idea Fest brings together changemakers to discuss Wisconsin's triumphs and failures to help reach a better state. Purchase your tickets today at CapTimesIdeaFest.com to join this premier thought festival.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.